Tonight our study begins in the fourth chapter of Isaiah. Last time we had gotten down through the first verse, really, of this fourth chapter, and the first verse goes with the third chapter of Isaiah, and it begins by saying, "And in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying." The phrase, "and in that day," probably should not be here, because the earlier manuscripts do not have it. But now we find the second verse also begins with the phrase, "And in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious." So we're beginning a new passage, and this passage has reference now to the return of God's people from the captivity, the return of Judah from the captivity back to the land of Judea and the city of Jerusalem. And that's what the prophecy is about. But this prophecy also has a greater fulfillment in the fact that it's talking about the church today. The true Zion, the true tabernacle of God, not made with men's hands. That's what it has reference to today. And so when it says, "In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious," the branch of the Lord is a prophecy about Christ. He was to be a shoot that came up from the root of Judah. And of course he was that shoot that came from that root stock or that remnant that was left. And so the branch of the Lord then shall be beautiful and glorious, speaking of God's people. "And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel." Now, them that are escaped of Israel would be, of course, those who came back from the captivity and were allowed to reoccupy the land. And probably most of these, of course, were not the original ones taken out, but it was their offspring because they were in that captivity some 70 years. But they were allowed to come back and reoccupy the land, and they would be referred to as them that are escaped of Israel. Now, that applies in the greater fulfillment, of course, to us in the church today who have escaped from the captivity that we were in whenever we were the bondsmen of the devil. And Babylonian captivity has always been looked upon as a symbol of the captivity of God's people whenever they have been carried away into another land, into another country, into another system of things from what God originally intended. And one of the greatest symbols today of Babylonian captivity is, of course, the Roman church, which is the apostate church, and all of the offspring of the Roman church, which are those that are referred to when he speaks of her as being the mother of harlots. So the fruit of the earth is going to be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. The earth is going to produce the things that are good for these people. That is, they're going to be back in the land of God, and they're going to have the things that are going to be beautiful and appropriate for them. Now, as you will see, their being taken away into captivity was a result of things not being appropriate for them. God brought about some calamities upon them, but not so on those that are escaped of Israel. "And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem." He that is left in Zion and he that it remaineth in Jerusalem, of course, this happens to be those who had come back from the captivity, or the true church today, which has been delivered from its bondage. They are the ones that are left in Zion and the ones that remaineth in Jerusalem. "And they shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem." Now, this idea of being written among the living indicates to us that there was some kind of a roll or list kept of the people who were members of Jerusalem or the nation of Judea. Ezekiel 13 and 9 alludes to this also. And of course, even in the New Testament, we have several references made to the names being written in the Book of Life. And these people were very careful about keeping their genealogy, proving that there were descendants of the original Israel. And so these lists, no doubt, were taken as something quite important and that they gave a lot of credence to. Well, he says that they'll be called holy, even everyone that's written among the living in Jerusalem. Now, in verse 4, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. Now, this people who were left, which would be the remnant of Jerusalem, or which would be in the greater fulfillment, the true church, would be a people that have been had the filth washed away. Now, today we have filth washed away by, of course, baptism, and they also had purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof. That is the absolute sins that he seems to depict here as being blood would also have to be purged from them. Now, when they came back from their captivity, they were certainly a changed people. They were no more idolaters. They had come out from idolatry, and they had learned a lesson a very, very hard way. And so they then were much, much more fit and more appropriate to worship God than had been their ancestors who'd gone away 70 years before them. But now with Christians today, we also are, when we've come out from the world and have been purged and been washed, we also are more appropriate to attend to the things of God than we could ever have been, not having been purged or washed. But notice how he says that this was accomplished. He said that it was done, one, by the spirit of judgment, and two, by the spirit of burning. And this seems to allude to the practice of purifying metals. The way you would purify a metal that had impurities in it would be, number one, to place a judgment upon it. That is, you would determine what this impure metal had wrong with it and what it needed in the way of a correction. There'd be a judgment placed upon it. If you didn't know what the problem was, then you wouldn't know very well how to go about correcting it. And so it was in the Old Testament with God's people. God knew what the problem was. He knew these people had turned away from him, that they were disobedient, that they were ignorant, that they were not considerate of him, that they had gone into idolatry. And so a judgment then was pronounced. And this was a necessary thing in order to purge them. And then after the judgment, that is, after he determined what was wrong, then the spirit of burning was placed upon them. So just like heating up metals and melting away the impurities and eradicating those things that are not desirable, the spirit of burning then was a necessary part of the process. Well, we'll find that even today, whenever we want to make a correction in our life, the first thing that has to come about is this spirit of judgment. We have to make a determination as to what's wrong with us. We have to pronounce a judgment upon our actions as to whether or not they are appropriate or not. And whenever we find those that are not appropriate, then we apply to that the spirit of burning to bring about the proper purging and purifying of ourselves, just as God did and still does with his people. And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense. Now this phrase of every dwelling place of Mount Zion, this phrase has, of course, reference to the fact that Mount Zion, that holy and celebrated mountain in the vicinity of Jerusalem, that was the place from which his law was to come, even in the lesser fulfillment of this prophecy, and certainly in the greater fulfillment of the prophecy. And so every dwelling place of Mount Zion, that is, wherever Mount Zion happens to be, and the wording here is not the same in all the translations. It's a little bit difficult to see exactly how the wording should be. And upon her assemblies. Now, all of the assemblies that have to do with Mount Zion, which this may very well be an initial reference to the use of the synagogues, because they hadn't used synagogues up to this time, and it's only thought that it was during and after the captivity that synagogue came into being. So this could be a reference to those assemblies known as the synagogues. I don't know this, but I'm just conjecturing this. But it certainly could also apply then to the various assemblies of the church today. Now, what's he going to do to these assemblies? He's going to create a cloud and a smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. Now this is certainly very similar to what he says in Exodus 13, verses 21, in which he was talking about leading and protecting the children of Israel. He says in Exodus 13, 21, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people." So that's a direct allusion to what he had originally done with them when they came out of the land of Egypt. He says, when you get back into Israel and you become the escaped of Israel, then I am going to lead you with this pillar of cloud and smoke by day and the pillar of fire by night. And so he says, "For upon all the glory shall be a defense." This will be God's presence and God's defending of those principles and things which are right and of his people. "And there shall be a tabernacle." Now, a tabernacle, of course, originally was just a tent. And it was a very, very common thing for people in that country to carry a tent with them whenever they traveled. And they used this tent for protection against the hot sun and for protection against the stormy elements that might come in the desert. So he says, "And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge and for a covert from storm and from rain." So this tabernacle that God would give them would be a protection. And it may be the defense that he was referring to in verse 5. "It'll be a protection. It'll be for a shadow in the daytime." That is, it'll be to give them shade from the hot sun, from the heat. "And then it'll also be for a place of refuge and for a covert." And the word covert means a secret hiding place from storm and from rain. So this tabernacle that God would give them would be a place to protect them. And he's speaking here in figurative language when we think of temporal things, but it is very literal when we think of spiritual things. We do have a spiritual tabernacle given to us by the Lord in which we can take refuge, which we can use as a secret hiding place, which we can use as a shade or shadow in the daytime from the heat, and then it makes then for protection for us. So there's a beautiful little illustration given here in this fourth chapter, verses 2 through 6, of the way God is going to take care of Israel after they were purified, and how that he was going to set up his sanctuary for them to dwell and to serve him in. Now, beginning in the fifth chapter,